Iran's leader says events marking the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani proved that his martyrdom only promoted his campaign. Russia ruling out any concessions to the U.S. in talks on Ukraine. It says it's disappointed over signals from Washington ahead of the negotiations. And anti-vaxxers turning out in cities across France to voice their anger at the government's planned restrictions. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, top story, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the United States assassination of Lieutenant General Soleimani has only further boosted the very campaign that the anti-terror commander set in motion. Well, the leader said that Washington's miscalculations have resulted in the U.S. government making wrong decisions, which in turn have led to its failure. Also in his comments, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. profound animosity toward the Islamic Republic emanates from the religious nature of Iran's establishment. According to the leader, tyrants have always been opposed to movements and establishments with a religious foundation. The leader delivered that speech on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Iran against the dictatorial rule of the then Pahlavi monarch. All right, now let's bring in Said Mustafa Khoshjesh, political analyst. Good to have you with us, Mustafa. So it's what happened after the assassination of General Soleimani was one highlight of the leader's speech, emphasizing unity and solidarity and other points. Let's have your comments on that.
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, I've been saying quite for a long time that the main or the root cause of the U.S. Miscalculations or wrong deeds with regard to Iran is its wrong perception of Shiite Islam and the impact that Ashura and Imam Hussein's martyrdom has left on this nation. When there are very sensitive junctures in Iranian history, especially after the Islamic Revolution, even before that, under the rule of the Pahlavi regime, there have been too many instances and the developments and events that have happened because of the impact of Ashura. And whenever there is some kind of crisis in the country, this kind of spirit, religious understanding of Shiite Islam and the core of Islam has surfaced to show itself. People take to the streets to support the establishment. And the funeral of Haj Qasem Soleimani, who was martyred in a U.S. terror attack 2 years ago, was one of such instances. They wrongly imagined that if they assassinate Haj Qasem Soleimani, then they have eliminated the man who had pushed U.S. Hegemonic designs and plans for this region into failure twice in the first a decade and the second decade of this century, and they imagine that for a third time now that we are going to impose our plan in West Asia, then our first step should be his elimination. But after assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, the lieutenant general and anti-terror commander, we have been witnessing a different situation. The number of attacks by the resistant forces on the U.S. troops in the region have, increased, and also the U.S. has started a very confusing withdrawal from this region. The U.S. demise has sped up. We all saw how they exited and escaped, actually, Afghanistan. And the time has arrived for their expulsion from Iraq. The U.S. troops have come under more and more attacks in Iraq, and they have also withdrawn from some bases in Qatar. They withdrew the top echelon of the CENTCOM from Doha, and it's very clear that the U.S. is growingly becoming weaker and weaker each day. And this has been somehow the impact of his of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. In other words, the lieutenant general is alive, and his martyrdom even caused the rapid fall of the U.S. and the U.S. hegemonic rule in this region in a way that some of the rivals or foes of the Islamic Republic have changed their calculations and are thinking of mending ties with Iran. We've seen the recent decision by the UAE, and the Saudis are in talks with Iran. They have come to realize that Iran is growing stronger and stronger, and now that the U.S. is escaping this region, now the main actor with a determining factor in decision making in equations is Iran. So the U.S. has definitely failed, especially after its anal Assad airbase came under attack, and Iran proved that it's the power in this region.
Mm-hmm. To be reckoned with, that's right. Said Mustafa Khoshesh, public analyst in Tehran. Thank you. Now, Iran has added 51 American individuals to its terror blacklist for involvement in the assassination of the country's top general, Soleimani, and his companions. We've discussed that issue during our news review program.
Tehran has updated its list of American individuals blacklisted for involvement in the assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and his companions. Iran's foreign ministry announced it's added 51 of U.S. officials to that list. It said that Washington acted in glorification of terrorism and violation of fundamental human rights by conducting, quote, this callous terrorist act. Ministry vowed heinous terrorist act will not diminish the resolute determination of Iran in following the path of General Soleimani in fighting terror. On January 3, 2020, U.S. assassinated Soleimani and his companions, including senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike just outside of Baghdad's international airport. Joining us now for the news review program is Sarah Flounders, co-director at International Action Center from New York, and John Philpott, international lawyer at the ICC, joining us from Montreal, Canada. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Ms. Flounders. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in New York. Having this blacklist of that, would like to tune in to this our website to see the comprehensive list of all the names, including the Boltons and the Trumps and the Pompeos and the Nikki Haleys, and along with everyone else that basically conspired to carry out this assassination, and in post-fact try to justify this attack on General Soleimani and his companions. Ms. Flounders, this list, obviously we know that Iran does not have the access to the kind of justice that it wishes to get on the international level, or does it, in your point of view? But nevertheless, what kind of impact do you think this kind of list will have as far as possibly preventing a similar act in the future?
Well, it's very important, even if Iran has no way of implementing at this time this list of those responsible for terrorism. Naming names is important, and not allowing Commander Soleimani to be forgotten, to just let this go, but to continue to both raise his name and his involvement in both organizing resistance and peace in the region, and cooperation among those who are really attempting to resist U.S. imperialism in the region. That's a big contribution. So refusing to allow his name to be forgotten, and at the same time naming the names of those who are directly responsible. And this list has grown. Last year, Iran announced 8 officials, and this year, the 51 officials, which it shows every policy has a whole list of people who put it into immediate practice. But most important is that President Trump, Bolton, Pompeo, and so on are right at the top, because that's who ordered this strike, this assassination this terrorist act, and that should be remembered, and there should be a demand put forth to the world that they be prosecuted and brought to justice. So the sanctions are an important political step.
Thank you, ma'am. And Mr. John Philpott, welcome to the program, sir. Your thoughts on what kind of impact, you know, compiling such a list may have of those complicit in the assassination of General Soleimani, the most highly decorated general, I should add, at the time in Iran's armed forces?
Well, it's very appropriate, and you can be sure that if it happened the other way around, they would have everybody named, and they'd be trying to extradite them from anywhere in the world. And we think of the case of Alex Saab, who did nothing and has been transferred to the U.S. from Cape Verde. So it's extremely important. And you've got to remember, or we have to remember, when you murder somebody in another country, you're liable for it. It is a crime. It's a terrorist crime. It's a murder. It's war of aggression. And I understand Iran has a treaty with Iraq that they can charge people for that killing of General Soleimani, a hero. We all knew about him back from the 80s when he was working defending Iran. And the U.S. come up with all kinds of silly, silly defenses, self-defense from anticipated attack. There's nothing to that. And so I think that some American officials are going to be frightened of traveling abroad. And the world is changing. Arrest warrants stay on the books, and these people should be brought to justice, and they can make their defenses. They can defend themselves in Iranian courts. Maybe some of their defenses are valid. I don't know. But Iran has the right to charge these people and apply Iranian criminal law. I don't know whether it has the death penalty or not. I think it probably does, but serious detention. And so that is a step forward, which it's kind of a tit-for-tat thing, but it is right. And it's right in international law.
Thank you for joining us on the program here. Thank you. You bet. John Philpott there joining us from Montreal, and Sarah Flounders joining us out of New York. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Let's move on. Iran's foreign minister says that reaching a good agreement is possible in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna if the Western side shows necessary goodwill and determination. Hossein Amir Abdullahian noted that Iran has the necessary determination to achieve a good agreement through goodwill. He made a comment in a phone call with his Indian counterpart. Meantime, Iran's top negotiator says participants are heading forward and making progress in the negotiations. Ali Bagharikani says the differences among the parties are narrowing, and this as the other sides have also voiced optimism about the pace of the negotiations. Now, in other news, the Syrian army intercepts a U.S. military convoy in the Hasaka countryside in the country's northeastern corner, forcing them to retreat. According to Syrian media, the convoy of four armored vehicles was driven out of a village north of the town of Tal Tamer. The U.S. military has stationed troops and equipment in the eastern and northeastern parts of Syria. The Pentagon claims that deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. The Damascus government says that the unlawful deployment violates Syrian sovereignty and is meant to plunder its resources. Well, soon the U.S. and Russia will be starting much-anticipated talks on several points of friction, straining their bilateral relations. But even before the meeting is held, both countries have voiced pessimism. Senior Russian diplomat Sergei Ryabkov says he's disappointed by signals from the U.S. and the EU on the eve of the Geneva talks. He says that the U.S. is insisting on unilateral Russia concessions, but that Moscow will not agree to any concession. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says many of Moscow's proposals are simply non-starters. The talks are being held at the request of the Kremlin, that's seeking a wide-ranging new security agreement with the White House. The dispute over Ukraine will likely top the agenda. Also, arms control, human rights, and armed conflicts around the globe will likely be at the heart of discussions. The Russia-U.S. talks will be held on Sunday and Monday, and this will be followed by a Russia-NATO meeting scheduled for Wednesday. Kazakhstan says that Russian-led peacekeepers are now protecting several of its strategic facilities, and that's why the country is struggling to contain the deadliest violence in its 30-year history. According to the presidential office, 5,800 people have been arrested, a significant number of them foreign citizens. The former prime minister and also former intelligence chief are in detention on suspicion of treason. State of emergency is in place over the turmoil that has killed dozens, including police officers, over the past week. President Kasym Tokayev has made it clear he'll show no leniency toward the rioters, telling his security forces to fire without warning. Meantime, a Russia-led regional security organization has sent troops into Kazakhstan to bring back order at the president's request. The chaos broke out over a hike in fuel prices. Protests continued even after the government resigned and the president restored fuel price caps. Protests against COVID restrictions once again hit Europe amid an explosion in the number of infections there. In France alone, some 100,000 people turned out in Paris and other cities to voice their anger. The government's plans to further restrict the unvaccinated are drawing much criticism. Once approved by the Senate, the new law will require everyone above 12 to show their vaccine passes while entering a restaurant, using public transport, or attending an event. A negative test will be no longer enough. Similar protests were held in Italy and Germany. Some countries in Europe have been reporting record infections, mostly blamed on Omicron. France has reported some 300,000 cases. Britain, Italy, and Russia have also witnessed record numbers. That's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard.
1929, Black Tuesday.
The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and we'll prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well. And if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others? I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. the special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued Gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued Gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the U.S. dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the U.K. And then the U.S., reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. That makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the UK. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the US. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline, and as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again here next time on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a genuine pleasure and an absolute honor to be with you guys and to have a share in your precious and valuable time. And I am ever so grateful that you guys take time out of your day to hopefully join in our little discussions that we have. I don't necessarily consider myself as a creative person. I don't know whether it's because of my anxiety that I constantly am in a state of brain fog, or because I haven't dabbled in enough things that demand that sort of any degree of creativity in general, but I do understand that in life you need to be creative. Sometimes you need to be impulsive, sometimes you need to be spontaneous, sometimes you need to be innovative, you need to think outside the box. You need to do something out of character, get out of your comfort zone and stuff like that. It might sound cliche, but it is necessary. It's necessary for our growth because there's like, well, some people are born creative. My brother was born creative, God bless him. And some aren't very much, right? But it's definitely something that we can train ourselves to achieve. You know, human beings can do anything they set their mind to. I bet if we really set our mind to it, we could grow an extra limb, but no one's really wanted to do that before, I think. But the point is that some people are born creative and they lead pretty creative minds, pretty creative lives. And by creative, I mean almost every corner of their lives possesses an element that sets their soul on fire. Otherwise, they cannot continue, right? And then some people aren't necessarily born that creative. Everyone has a certain degree of creativity, but they're not like genius creative. And it can be developed. Let's hear a short story. You know what? Let's do that so we can get a better idea of what we mean by creativity. And we're going to be right back.
A man was exploring caves by a seashore when he found a bag with a bunch of hardened clay balls. The balls looked like someone had intentionally rolled the clay and left them out in the sun to bake. Perhaps some children made them while they were at the beach, the man thought. They didn't look much, so he took the bag out of the cave with him. As he strolled along the beach, he threw the clay balls one by one out to the oceans as far as he could. The clay balls would fly and disappear in the ocean. The man threw several clay balls in the ocean until he dropped one of the balls and it cracked open. Inside the clay was a beautiful, precious stone. This excited the man and he started breaking the remaining clay balls. Each of it contained different types of precious stones. He found thousands of dollars worth of jewels in around 20 clay balls that was left with him. He had been on the beach for a long time and he must have thrown away many clay balls with hidden treasure into the sea. He could have had a treasure worth of tens of thousands rather than just thousands if he had not thrown the clay balls away. Most of the time we look at someone or even ourselves and we see the external clay vessel. The vessel doesn't always look sparkly and nice, so we never bother to look inside it. We tend to see and judge a person and deem them as less important than the ones who are more beautiful, stylish, well-known, or wealthy. We forget to look inside for the unique treasure that each one of us holds. May we not come to the end of our lives and realize that we have thrown away a fortune in friendship, love, or any relationship because we did not attempt to look for the gems hidden in bits of clay. Let us all relish the treasures each of us hold inside us.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Just being creative in life in finding solutions, being able to think outside the box when we are stuck in a box, what being able to look beyond the curb, look beyond that dead end, beyond that wall, it requires creativity. Being able to trust in God and rely on what He has for you tomorrow is thinking outside of the box and being creative. And oftentimes I found that that is the best solution to all my problems. It doesn't mean that I will just sit in the box and do nothing and, you know, wait for God to come around with a box cutter and crack the little sucker open and release me. No, that's not what it means. It means that once I rely on God, once I choose this route of creativity, I will be given the strength to even gnaw my way out of this box if I have to, because I know Allah has something good in store for me outside of it. By hook or by crook, I'm going to make it through this moment because I know God's got my back. That's a form of creativity, I think. And perhaps the best form, to know that my Creator is the creator of all things, even creativity itself, and that He will create a way, He will find a way, He will make a path. Another way to develop this sense of creativity in our lives is being more mindful of the situations we have, we're in, and the opportunities we have, and not just, you know, passing them by all indifferent and passive and nonchalant. Being mindful of the situations, because once we're mindful, we increase the level of our awareness, we connect with the elements and the situations around us better, and then we are more able to soak in that moment and analyze each factor as it is. And once we do that, we gain knowledge about it. Once we gain knowledge, we can make better decisions, and that, you know, enters creativity. So practicing mindfulness, practicing the art of living in the moment, of being in the now, so you can make a proper decision for the now. If I am in the now, but I'm constantly thinking about the tomorrow or the past, I won't be able to understand the now well enough to collect information and data for it to use in a creative manner in the future. Being mindful, practicing mindfulness, heartfulness, gratitude for the moment I'm in right now, really being still in the presence, is a way for us to develop creativity and just appreciate life in general. Sort of like how artists live their lives, you know? Or photographers. Have you seen a photographer and an artist? Every moment they're just looking for little details around themselves to capture, to savor, to save in their memory, to help them through the unknown of tomorrow. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah tatma'innul qulub.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is...